The fact that I'm sitting down this morning should be an ominous sign. I'm getting comfortable, you should as well. Last week I said that I wanted to speak on the issue of same-sex marriage, and I want to do that in the context of the negative commandment of Jesus in Matthew chapter 7, which is, do not judge. So would you turn again to that? And I know that Heather spoke on that only a couple of weeks ago, but I do feel it's important that we revisit that for a few minutes at least this morning. Matthew chapter 7, we're going to read from verse 1. Do not judge, or you too will be judged, for in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly and remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not judge. Well, here is a negative commandment from Jesus that is universally accepted, particularly by non-Christians who love to take it and throw it in the face of Christians, but wouldn't know where it is in the Bible to save their lives. And it's true, isn't it, that if there's something that's levelled against Christians, it's do not judge. Thou shalt not judge me. Thou shalt not size me up and judge me on what I wear, where I go, who I spend time with. And topically this morning, thou shalt not judge me on the basis of my sexual orientation or my desire to marry someone of the same sex. Right? That is probably one of the most common phrases that's levelled against Christians, do not judge. And it seems to me that Christians and all religious people have a tendency to judge. Why do we do that? Well, I think there's two reasons. The first is this. I think we're angry. And when I say angry, I don't mean maybe angry is not the right word. I think we're irked. I think we're a little bit miffed by the fact that there are people who are sinning spectacularly and they seem to be getting away with their sin. In recent years, 4 or 5 years ago, in fact, there was a guy called Rob Bell, still alive, and Rob Bell wrote a book, and his book was deconstructing the whole idea, the whole New Testament idea of hell. And Rob Bell copped it in the ribs from conservative Christians, and particularly Christians who are quite enamoured with the whole concept of hell, because they've already worked out a whole group of people who they know are going to hell or should be going to hell. And I do know of one pastor who was continually hounded by people in his church and outside of his church about this book by Rob Bell. His standard answer became this: I hope he's right. Don't you? It was a very controversial answer. He's a conservative Christian. And he said this: I hope he's right. Don't you? And when he said that, it set people back on their heels, people who are too enamoured, too happy with the concept that God is going to condemn people to hell. Now, just for the record, I do believe in the reality of hell. But I say that with a heavy heart. I don't say that with any glee or any sense of self-satisfaction. And I think we tend to be judgmental because we're kind of angry that there's people out there doing stuff that we know they shouldn't be doing, and they seem to be getting away with it. I think the second reason that we're judgmental is that we have this tendency to be self-righteous. And what we do is this: we compare our relative goodness with the relative evil of other people, and all the time we keep God on a leash. We say, just stay there, God. Let me make my comparisons between what I think is my goodness and this person's evil. You just stay there, God. And we don't allow God's standard of holiness to impinge on the discussion. And I think they're the reasons, honestly, why we tend to judge people, or why we tend... No one in this room, of course, to the exclusion of everyone in this room, I know you don't judge people, but people out there do judge, and I think they're the reasons that we're angry. Look at that person doing what they're doing. How can they get away with that? Meanwhile, I'm trying to live a holy, righteous life. Or we're self-righteous. And you know the thing with self-righteous people is that very seldom are self-righteous people self-aware. So let's look at what Jesus says. Do not judge. Don't confront me. Don't criticize me. Don't compare me. Don't size me up and write me off. Do not judge. And then here is this warning. Or you too will be judged. For with the measure that you use in judging, you too will be judged. So the question is this. How do I want to be judged? This is just a little bit too loud, Rob. It's ringing. That's better. How do I want to be judged? And the answer is this. I want to be judged not. Right? How do you want to be judged? You want to be judged not. And if you do need to judge me, I want you to take into consideration a whole lot of factors about me. I want you to take into consideration my family, my circumstances, my insecurities. I want you to take into consideration the fact that I've had some major traumas in my life, that I've fallen out of a tree, that I've been concussed at least once, that I've been under general anaesthetic about 5 times, which accounts for my occasional memory loss and the odd blonde moment. So if you are going to judge me, I want you to take into consideration all of these things. One of the most contentious issues that exists when we as a church explore this whole issue of homosexuality is that there are many, many Christians who will flat out refuse to accept that for some people who have homosexual leanings or tendencies, that there could actually be factors that are beyond their control. There are some Christians who will just not even entertain that idea. Now, I'm not an expert, but I have read widely in this area. And so the research and the hypotheses which relate not just to homosexuality, but they also relate to bisexuality and asexuality. And these studies are done by geneticists, they're done by sociologists, and in some cases they're even done by theologians. And the weight of evidence is this, that there is, at least, in some circumstances, potentially a small amount of genetic disposition towards. But you see, there's some Christians who will just write that off and say, no, it's just a lifestyle choice, and they condemn them. They become the judge, the jury, and the executioner. Jesus said, with the measure that you judge, you too will be judged. And then he goes on to say this. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Now, 2 things about that. One is this. When Jesus first said that, people would have been rolling on the floor in laughter. Because it actually is a very, very humorous phrase. Now, can you try and picture this? Someone is trying to remove the speck from somebody else's eye, and meanwhile they've got a roof joist in their own eye. This would have been material for the Three Stooges. And I say that with all respect to the Scriptures, because this was a very, very funny thing for Jesus to say. And you know, sometimes we just need to lighten up because we're so serious. And when Jesus first said this, it would have been very, very funny. Now, I guess you had to be there, but it would have been funny. How can you take? How can you say to your brother, "Let me take the speck out of your eye," when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite! First, take the plank out of your own eye. Ah, we get the message, don't we? Jesus is telling us to mind our own business. Jesus is saying to us, you know, there's a speck in your brother's eye, but there's a roof joist in your own eye. Moral of the story, mind your own business. No, he doesn't say that. He says, first take the plank out of your own eye. So Jesus starts a list. The first thing is this: take the plank out of your own eye. What is the plank in our own eye as it relates to homosexuality and same-sex marriage? Let me suggest a few things to you. Because homosexuality is only one of a number of sexual distortions. Homosexuality sits alongside of premarital sex. And it's actually commonplace now for couples, young couples, including Christian couples, to engage in premarital sex. That's the plank in our eye. What about adultery? The rates of adultery in the church are as high as the rates of adultery outside of the church. What about pornography? Many Christians are engaged in pornography, hard and soft pornography. And what about this one? This is a big issue. What about child sex abuse, child sexual abuse? These things are the planks in our eye. And Jesus says to us, first, remember, first is one of a number. First, take the plank out of your own eye. And you're saying to me, well, John, does that mean that we need to clean up our act before we can or should say anything about same-sex marriage? Do we need to clean it up completely? Do we need to be spotless? And I would say, no, what it means is this, that we need to have before our God and our culture a sense of humility and a sense of repentance that says we actually do have a plank in our eye. And at the very least, it means that we should be willing to accept the level of the accusation of hypocrisy that may well be leveled against us when we speak out against this issue of same-sex marriage. So, here it is. This is great, isn't it? Jesus says, first take the plank out of your eye so that you can see clearly the speck. And so we're thinking, great, because if I take the plank out of my eye, I can then see the speck in my brother's eye. And when I see the speck in my brother's eye, it causes me to see the dysfunction or whatever it might be in my own life. I can then deal with that and I feel a lot better. In other words, if I'm ever tempted to judge thee, I should stop to see traces in me. And when I see traces in me, I can clean up my act and then happy days for me. But Jesus doesn't stop there. You see, at the epicenter of Christianity is love one another. So when Jesus says, take the plank out of your eye so that you can see clearly the speck in your brother's eye, he goes on then to say, then you can remove the speck from your brother's eye. In other words, judge not doesn't mean care not. Judge not doesn't mean act not. Judge not doesn't mean protest not. Judge not means don't size someone off. Summon up and then just write them off. And secondly, don't size someone up and just walk away. That's what judge not means. So judge not doesn't mean that we're not going to act, and judge not doesn't mean that we're not going to care, and judge not doesn't mean that we're not going to engage with the speck in our brother or our sister's eye. Do you understand that? And Jesus spins the whole thing around. We've heard judge not, which means you just leave everyone alone. Let them live their life according to the way that they're committed to living their life, according to their own conscience. And don't do or say anything. And Jesus says, no, it doesn't mean that. It means take the plank out of your own eye so that you can see clearly to engage with the speck in your brother's eye. Okay, now that was just the introduction, all right? Same-sex marriage and the Word of God. So God created mankind in His own image. In the image of God, He created them, male and female, He created them. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. And she shall be called woman, for she was taken out of the man. That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. This scripture is the foundation for what we know as the traditional, natural family, which starts with a husband and a wife, a man and a woman. And this statement then is the foundation from which many marriage acts, including our own, derive their definition of marriage. So here is what our marriage act says. The long-standing institution of the natural family resulting from marriage between a man and a woman as affirmed by the Marriage Act in 1961. Therefore, marriage is exclusionary by design, and it is restrictive by definition. Let me unpack that a little bit. There are age restrictions. So in our country, you can't marry if you're under the age of 18 unless you have consent from your parents. And even then, you can only be 16 or 17. You can't marry under the age of 16. So there are age restrictions. There are gender restrictions. It really is a recent thing in the last 15 years that countries have legalized same-sex marriage and in doing so have changed the definition of their marriage act. This is not an ancient idea, this is a recent idea. There are kinship restrictions. You cannot marry your brother or sister or your father or your mother, and in some countries you cannot marry into your extended family. So there are restrictions on marriage by its definition. There's exogamy, which is in South Korea. Here's an example. There is a general taboo against a man marrying a woman with the same family name, which is really quite a challenge in South Korea because 20% of the people have a surname of Kim. But there are different tributaries of the Kim family so that you all find a husband and a wife with a surname Kim Kim. But there are restrictions. Endogamy, restrictions on intertribal marriage. Example, in Israel, if you're an Israelite by nationality, you're an Israeli, you cannot marry outside of the Israeli people. So a revision of the definition of marriage will remove the limitations, and marriage will not be defined. It will be a matter of who I choose to marry. Or to put it another way, to remove the inherent difference in sexual specificity from marriage, it makes marriage not a realization and celebration of the difference between male and female that protects, dignifies, and complements each. It simply is a matter of choice. That is the triumph of the individual's emotion and will. In other words, marriage will become who I choose to marry. And, of course, this is really the thin edge of the wedge because the polygamists are saying, hey, if countries are allowing same-sex marriage, why is it that we are restricted in having one marriage partner? And then where to from here? You see the danger? If you take away the definition of marriage, then marriage becomes a matter of who I choose to marry. I want to say this also, that in speaking about the inherent difference between men and women, what I've noticed in even in same-sex partnerships or marriages, one of the partners is designated the wife or the husband. Now, whether they, and I don't mean to be judgmental in that, but what I mean to say in that is that you cannot get away from this inherent reality that God intended for a man and a woman to be united. And the example that I would use, in some ways I quite like this lady because I think she's quite a good TV presenter, but Ellen DeGeneres married a lady called Portia de Rossi, who's an Australian, and Ellen will refer to her partner as her wife. Well, if she refers to her partner as her wife, it then means that she sees herself as the husband. It's such an anomaly, but you cannot get away from the inherent understanding and idea that runs deep in the human psyche, that is age old and is entrenched in culture after culture, society after society. And people want to redefine that. Same-sex marriage and freedom. Here's some scary thoughts for you. There is no place in Australia for people who do not agree with a proposed new definition of marriage. Our politicians. I won't name names, but there are politicians who have actually said that. There's no place. So if you disagree, or if I disagree with the proposed revision, there's no place for us in this country. According to some. The Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, acknowledges the current proposals to change the Marriage Act do not protect people who will never accept the state's new definition of marriage. This is the Human Rights Commissioner. This has got to be our aha moment. This has got to be our culture's, hang on, let's wait a minute moment. Paul Kelly, not the singer Paul Kelly, but the editor-at-large of the Australian paper, which is actually a proponent and supporter of same-sex marriage. If you read the Australian newspaper, they are a supporter, says this. He concedes all of the current proposals to change the definition of marriage contain no protection from individuals' freedom of conscience and inadequate protections for the religious freedom and amounts to calculated intolerance by same-sex lobbyists and their political supporters. In other words, if this is enacted in the way that it's proposed, and remember that on the 11th of August, when Parliament resits, this is going to go to Parliament. This is going to go to the floor of Parliament as a proposal, and there's current discussion at the Labor conference whether that will be a binding vote or a conscience vote. They haven't decided yet. I'm pretty sure the coalition will allow a conscience vote at least. This is happening in a week or so. Now, this is a scary thing because in the States now, there are people who are hauled before the laws, that the courts, people like pastors and ministers, who are refusing on the basis of their conscience to marry same-sex couples. And this is where this is heading. And this is a man who is writing for a paper who actually supports the movement towards same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage and redefining the family. Children need a biological mum and dad. This is the intended ideal for children. On Wednesday night, every fortnight Wednesday night, Karen and I go down to our daughter and son-in-law, or up to, Maribor is up, Brisbane is down. We go up to Maribor and we spend time with our daughter and son-in-law. And on Wednesday night, I just observed this, it's nothing profound, but Troy was on the floor with Neo, our grandson, and he was wrestling him, or Neo was wrestling Troy. I wasn't quite sure what was going on, because Neo's quite big and strong. And then Troy was throwing Neo up and catching him most of the time. And then Troy shoved a box over Neo, took the floor, the bottom of the box out, and shoved this box around Neo, and Neo's walking around like this. And I noticed a father being a father, and then I noticed Neo's mum, my daughter Shreya, kind of mortified at some of the things that Troy was doing, particularly throwing Neo up, you know. And because if you miss him, he's going to come down with a mighty thud. And I watched her nurturing him and feeding him, and I watched all the things that a mum would do and all the things that a dad would do. And I know some people will say, well, that's very, very stereotypical. And yes, it is. And I make no apologies for that, because children need a biological dad and a biological mum, not a nominated dad and a nominated mum. Now, I say that guardedly because I know that there are less than ideal circumstances that people live in where there's a single mum or there's a single dad. But I also know that if you spoke to those people, like I have, they would say, I wish I had my partner. I wish I had the support of my partner who's either a mother or a father. Same-sex marriage and ethics and morality, and on this note I'm going to finish, a symptom of a bigger problem. Ethics and morality are used, the terms ethics and morality are used interchangeably, and it's actually a sign of the confusion that pervades our society. So let's launch into this scintillating discussion for a few minutes and then we'll finish. Ethics is from the word ethos, or stall. The word ethos is actually the Greek word for a stall where a horse or a cow will spend the night, and it's meant to be a place of permanence. Morals is from the Greek word morai, which is not an eel, it's a descriptive word which describes the behavioural patterns of a given society. Ethics are the principal foundational obligations on a group of people. You may not be aware of this, but as a pastor, I am obligated to conduct my ministry according to a code of ethics. That they're not negotiable for me. They are what I need to use as the framework for my ministry. They're obligations. They're ought-tos. You ought to do this. You ought to do that. You ought not to do this, or you ought not to do that. Morals are the way that those obligations are expressed. When morality is identified with ethics, the normal becomes the normative and the imperative is swallowed up by the status quo. We've got this confusion in our culture where we've separated out where we've confused ethics and morality. Ethics are, this is how we ought to live. Morality then is the expression of that in a group of people. But what we've done is we've combined those two. And the imperative, the ought-tos, are swallowed up in what is normal. So this creates a kind of statistical morality where we are under pressure to keep up with the Joneses or the Kellys. So recently in Ireland, right, the Irish have accepted same-sex marriage. So then there's pressure on other countries to keep up with the Joneses or the O'Shaughnessys, whatever it might be, or the Kellys. Same in the States. The States have accepted same-sex marriage, and now there is this statistical morality that is rolling over us like an irresistible wave. And no one is saying, hey, what's ethical and what's moral here? We're all just swallowed up in what's normative or normal. Here's what happens. We compile an analysis of behaviour patterns, and if we find, for example, a majority of people participating in premarital sex, we declare that that's normal. So it's normal now for, as I said, young couples to engage in premarital sex, to try before you buy, whatever, however you want to express it, that's normal. Step number two, we move quickly from normal to a description of what is authentically human. Humanness is defined by what people do, i.e. the normal thing. They have sex before marriage, which is then said to be good. It's good for people to have sex before marriage. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying this is what our society, this is the logic that we are entrenched in. Step three is to declare patterns which deviate from the normal as abnormal. In this logic, chastity is seen as abnormal, and virgins are vilified and made fun of. And you see, we've fallen for the three-card trick, and in three easy steps, we have exchanged the truth about God for a lie. So what's happening in the same-sex agenda is actually symptomatic of what's happening right across our culture and what's rolling on in many, many, many issues. So, let me finish with a concluding thought. There are people who are saying that this is the greatest moral issue facing our society today. For the reasons that I've outlined, I think it's a very significant moral issue. I'm not sure it's the greatest, but it is a very serious issue. I think the greatest moral issue is the fact that, you know, we're going to have morning tea in a moment. We're going to have tea, coffee, water, juice. And today there are kids who will not drink any water at all and will die because they can't drink fresh water. And I sometimes think that those sorts of issues, to the heart of God, they're the really, really big issues. But I don't want to diminish this in any way, shape or form. So, as I said, you and I have got probably a couple of weeks to respond to this. The church in this country has got a couple of weeks to respond to this. So in the next day or two, I'm going to send you out some links. Watch your emails. If you don't have email, come and I'll give you a hard copy of ways and means that you and I can say, hey, in a way that is not judgmental, in a way that is not sizing up people and writing them off and not sizing up people and walking away, we want our voice to be heard on this issue. Yeah? That's it from me. And Nick's going to come and lead us in some songs.